I'll call the meeting to order for the local government committee. First bill we take up is going to be House File 519, yes.
Your bill.
And Representative Hilty is going to take over the chair. Nelson, and welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Chair Hilty. And thank you for offering to step in the chair for the vice chair. Is going to be a little bit late.
So, Representative Nelson, you have a motion for...
I'd like to move House File 519 to be recommended and passed and re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations and Reform. And we have an amendment that should be in the packet. And to delete all amendments, A090131.
Seeing that it's a delete all amendment, I presume that's the form in which you'd like the bill to be discussed. Is there any discussion to the amendment? I don't think we have a quorum. We do? Yes, we do. All right.
So I'm going to move the A090131 amendment.
Very good. Is there any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of its adoption, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Nelson, to your bill.
And basically what this bill is, a bill about non-conforming lots on shoreland, non-conforming shoreland lots. And with the DNR, Representative Hillstrom last year set up a working group with the DNR and interested parties to come up with a resolution on this issue that's been going on since 1972. And this was a compromise that came out of it, and the amendment that I put on was a compromise that came out at the last a couple weeks ago between all the groups, and just deleted one section that was problematic with the realtors, and we worked out a different way of getting about that with the realtors, but they agreed, instead of having the language that was in the original bill and statute, they agreed to put in their seller's disclosure statement. There's a copy of that in your packet also. Language that talks about if it's a shoreline lot, would the seller disclose whether they know that they're, whether it's a conforming lot? If they don't know, it instructs the buyer to check with their local county to make see if the lot conforms and if they're able to build on it before they buy. And with that, that's why we took out the first section. This bill, like I said, there's not total peace in the valley. There's we worked with the Builders Association. They still have a couple issues with the bill, but for the most part, this is a compromise bill that has come through. And I have Kent Locksmull here from the DNR, and he'll explain the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kent Locksmull, the director of DNR Water. This issue has been before the legislature numerous times over the last few years, and as Representative Nelson said last session, Representative Hillstrom committed to working on this during the interim and coming up with a solution. So this is a much broader, I think, solution than was proposed last year, and this solves many of the problems. One of the things Representative Hillstrom did during the interim was ask for examples of problems, and there wasn't a resounding response to that, but out of those examples that we got, there were 10 issues that directly related to this contiguous non-conforming lot issue, and this bill would solve 9 of those. There is an issue on non-conforming lots that some of these are just plain too small when you have 2 adjacent lots. And we can't solve everything, but I think we did quite a bit in solving this issue. The study group that we had included DNR, the League of Cities, the Association of Townships, the Association of Counties, the Realtors, and the Builders. And we worked through most of the issues. Now, if you have in your packet the talking points in the discussion, the line items that are referred to there in that referred to the original bill, so you have to correct them for and find them in the delete all amendments, and I'll do that as I walk through. We deleted two sections out of the original bill. Sections 1 and 5 both dealt with disclosure, and as Representative Nelson said, that's being dealt with through the realtor's disclosure statement. So Section 1 of the bill deals with the nonconformities, and the most of this just corrects, or not corrects, but clarifies how you look at the value. And on lines 1.2 to 1.25, that language there says, for a nonconforming structure that's located less than 50% of the required setback in the shoreline zone, if that's destroyed by fire, you should increase the setback if possible. This is the one section that the builders still have an issue with. They would prefer to leave it as is, which if it burns down and it's a nonconforming structure anywhere, not just in the shoreline, you can build on the same footprint, but you can't expand. So that's the issue that that still remains, and is, I suppose, for the committee's consideration. We feel that this is really a relatively small number of issues a year, the number of fires that you have that destroy homes, or tornadoes, or other actions that would destroy homes or cabins that are only at 50% of the setback. So we think that's very few issues.
Mr. Lachman, on the question of the footprint, I think, as I recall, this issue being discussed in the past, there was some question about whether you could expand square footage by building up as long as you didn't build out. Is that something that's addressed here?
Mr. Chairman, that's not specifically addressed here, but the existing law that allows for nonconformities, if they're destroyed, to be rebuilt, does not include expansion. So it doesn't say footprint, it says expansion. So I would think if you're attempting to add a second floor on, that would be an expansion and not be allowed.
Thank you.
Section 2 of the bill, and this bill deals with both municipal zoning and county zoning. So it repeats itself after we get through the county zoning. It's the same changes, essentially, for the municipal zoning. On lines 2.9 to 2.14, this allows development on a single nonconforming lot without regard to size, as long as you get the setback and the sewage treatment and the pervious coverage standards can be met. So it would, if you have just an individual lot that doesn't meet the current standards in the Shoreland District, if you meet the septic and the setback requirements and the impervious lot requirements, it could be built on. So this is a change from what's current standard in our rules and local ordinances.
Just a second, Mr. Lachman. Representative Eastland, you had a question. Is it to this section?
Well, yeah, it was to the one that we talked about.
You were
talking about.
Section 1,
go
ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, and I'm not sure how insurance works all the time in this case. I know in some cases, I know insurance requires you to rebuild to collect. And if we're in a situation where somebody is in a non-conforming lot, in a non-conforming house, it burns down, and they're unable to rebuild, can that have an impact on their ability to collect insurance?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't know the answer to that question. We can check and see if there's insurance folks that might be able to answer that, but I will have to get back to the committee on that question.
Well, we hope you will be able to do that, and please proceed.
On lines 2.15 to 2.25, this is the area that allows development on contiguous non-conforming lots And what it does is it changes the lot size requirement from right now to from 100% needing to meet 100% of the required size to needing only to meet 66% of the required size. And the reason it's 66% is lake classifications are general development is the most heavily developed lakes like a Mille Lacs or a Minnetonka. Recreational development are next in that line. It's a little bit more restrictive standard, and the most restrictive is natural environment. A lot width requirement for a recreational development is 150 feet. So if you reduce that by something larger, by only 75%, you don't get down to 100-foot width, which is the lot requirement for a general development lake. So when we were looking at this, and there have been standards developed in the North Central Lakes project several years ago that were looking at using a 75% size for these non-conforming lots, and we felt through the negotiations, we had 75% in these negotiations for a long time. We felt through these negotiations that it would be desirable to go to 66%, so you could get from a 150-foot lot width requirement on a recreational development lake down to a 100-foot lot requirement. That was a pretty standard lot width when some of these lots were formed prior to ordinances. Then the next section. On 2.28 to 2.33 is the area that allows the sale or acquisition of contiguous non-conforming lots when they both have dwellings on them. This issue came forward last year where individuals had two lots, two mortgages, two septic systems that were both compliant. But they were told by a county that they were contiguous and they couldn't be sold because they didn't meet the recreational development lot size standard. Ultimately, that county did provide a variance and allowed the sale of that. But as we looked at that issue, we felt it would be desirable to have, you have two contiguous lots, but they both have existing cabins on them. They both have existing septic systems that comply, that those should be allowed to be sold. And our primary concern when we were looking at this was having compliance with the septic standards. And the, you know, we did have some discussions on whether or not it should be a type 1 system, which is just a drain field and not a holding tank. But holding tanks are compliant with the PCA's septic standards. And we aren't rewriting PCA septic standards here. What we're doing is applying them, and applying them to existing structures would allow that type of situation to allow for the sale of contiguous lots. That, Mr. Chairman, then basically what happens is in Section 3 is the language that deals with cities. So it's the same changes for the cities that I just outlined for the counties. I can walk through those if you wish, although it's the same concept. There are a couple different words because of the way the statutes were structured. And then Section 4, this bill is written to be effective the day following final enactment. We know there are issues out there where sales are being withheld and that this would help some individual property owners. And that's a quick summary of the bill, Mr. Chair.
Discussion to the bill. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lacusmore, I'd like to ask you the same question I asked you out in the hall before we came in here. I know that this deals with tornado or fire or whatever if the property is destroyed or more than 50% of it is destroyed. The question is, what happens if it's a tear-down situation where an owner voluntarily removes the structure? Does this change in law affect those situations at all?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lanning, that situation would be handled through the local zoning authorities as it is now.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this change in law does not change anything from a state perspective with regard to a voluntary teardown of a property, that whatever rules are in place in that county or city would apply.
Chairman, Representative Lanning, that is correct.
Thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, when assessed value is determined, do they put a is it usually broken down so there's a value on the lot and a value on the improvement?
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative, generally, yes, that is true.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we would be talking about the value attached to the building itself in the 50% that we're talking about.
Mr. Chairman,
Eastman.
Yes.
Further discussion?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I believe most of the groups that we dealt with support this, but they don't object. Other than, like I said, the builder still had objection to that one section. So we believe that's important to stay in this bill.
Thank you. Duly noted. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Nelson renews his motion that
there's somebody wants to.
Oh, I see.
From the builders that wants to come speak on the bill.
Very well.
I could
yeah,
be.
I was thinking that had been resolved.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Lisa Burnett. I'm with the Builders Association of Minnesota. It's okay, Mr. Chair, I'm just being ignored.
I do my best, as you know.
I do, yes. You've always been very good to me. Just real quick to reiterate, we appreciate everything that the Department of Natural Resources did to work with the Builders Association of Minnesota. They educated me to a great extent on how a lot of these provisions work. We do still, however, have a problem with the fact that somebody is not allowed to come back and build on the footprint of what burned down. And Mr. Lacosmo very generously offered that only a handful of these, actually, let me back up a sec. I spoke with the DNR last week, and there are only a handful or so of houses or homes or structures that are in these setback areas right now. And if a fire, and then Mr. Lacosmo said that only a few burn down each year, these people ought to be able to build back on the same footprint that they had as long as they don't go beyond the boundaries that they already had and they apply for their permit within the first 180 days. We feel that that should stay the same. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Burnett? Seeing none, thank you. Mr. Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. Just want to briefly express our support for this bill. This has been an issue we have worked at with legislators for many years now. It's been very controversial, and we very much appreciate the author's attempt to help us finish a process where the local governments are able to preserve the authority they need to make good decisions for public health and safety. But at the same time, we allow people to have a reasonable ability to deal with their own properties. It's the balancing act local governments are used to having to deal with, and we think this bill takes a good step to improve that balance. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Johnson? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, I'm just referring back to the comments from the builders. I guess if there are a few that don't or aren't able to rebuild, and this is their home, I guess the question is what are the options for those people? I appreciate the fact that we're resolving this issue because I know it's a complicated issue, and I know it's created a lot of problems for local zoning agents and individuals that own lots, and a lot of the things of concern are resolved in here. But there are a number of people that do live on non-conforming lots, and that is their home and it is their place of residence. And I guess I haven't heard an answer to the question that I asked earlier. I'm not sure if it's in residential, but I know there are insurance plans that do not pay unless you rebuild. That's the way my farm insurance plan works. If a barn burns down and I don't rebuild it, I don't collect. And I guess I think that's an important issue here. I mean, if that's the case, basically, what are the options for those people? I mean, if they can't recover any of their costs and they're left with an unbuildable lot, I think I'm concerned about that.
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I don't know the detailed answer to the insurance part of the question. I can tell you what this bill does specifically is that if it is burned down by greater than 50%, what it says is that they can, the structure's setback must be increased by as much as possible. So if there's room on the lot for them to move it back to being closer, possible and reasonable conditions can be put. If there is no place to move it back, their septic tank is there and that's the only place it can be, they could rebuild in the same footprint. So it would only be moved back if it was determined by the local zoning authority there was some room to move it back. Otherwise, they can rebuild it there.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I mean, that's interesting. If it's 50% destroyed, then all of a sudden they have 100% rebuilding cost. Not 50%, because you can move it back on the lot, but it was only 50% destroyed. I think there's just some issues here that I'm trying to figure out what happens to somebody that gets stuck in a situation here where they lived in a house and it's non-complying, it's on a lot that's non-complying. There's a little more than 50% damage. They would like to fix it. They can't. If they could move it back on the lot, maybe they could. But now they're faced with 100% replacement cost. And so I just think there's a few people here who are really being treated unfairly, and I guess I would like to see that issue resolved before we would go ahead and move this bill out of here.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, and I'd certainly be happy to talk more, Representative, about it, but right now I believe what this does is says that if it's possible to move it back, they have to, but it does not. If it's not reasonable to do that, if it would mean they have to pay 100% of the cost versus, you know, paying 20% or whatever their deductible or, you know, insurance was, I think they'd have a very good case that that's not a reasonable requirement. I don't think it is intended to cause people to not be able to rebuild at all. It simply says if it's possible to improve the conformity of the setback from the lake, that they need to do that if it's more than 50% destroyed. And the 50% destroyed by fire or natural disaster is an existing nonconformity trigger. That's not new. So this is just tying that to distance from shoreland. That was the reason it was referred to that way.
Representative Eastman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I mean, I don't think that's what the bill says. I think what it says is that if from a zoning standpoint, if the position of the building can be improved, that you're going to be required to do that if your home is more than 50% destroyed. I think that's what the bill reads as far as the way I read the bill. It has nothing to do with what it costs the homeowner. And that's part of my question here, is that we're kind of leaving the person who has an investment in this land out of the equation. We're simply saying, you're out. There's no option for you. And I guess that's concerning to me that we would go down that road. It would seem more reasonable that in a situation where that is the case and you can't improve the structure, you can't improve the zoning and the setback and those kind of things. I agree with some of the concerns of the Builders Association here that, I mean, I think for the protection of somebody's investment, they ought to be able to at least replace what burned down, you know, without a huge penalty. And I don't see how that could occur here. What I'm seeing is a pretty big burden put on a few people here who are going to be in kind of a tough situation if they just happen to fall in this little crack of this bill. And I think it's a small crack, but I think it's an important one, and it's one that affects some people significantly.
And that's been, Mr. Chair, that's been one of the issues that was going on, and that's why they put as much as possible. And if it's not possible or not practicable, and I don't know if practicable would be a better word than possible, I don't know, splitting hairs there on that, but that was the discussion that the DNR wasn't going to be forcing this down but on people, but if it was possible to move it back and get it out of the impact area, they were going to want that done. But if it's not possible to be done, they'd be able to build exactly on the same footprint they already were on. That was the discussion from the DNR. That was the discussion from the counties as it came forward.
Representative
Eastman. Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I hear that, but I guess what I'm also hearing in the bill, I'm concerned about what you mean by not possible. I don't see anything in the bill that would say because it isn't economically possible for the person whose house burned down. That's not what I see in the bill. What I see is it's not possible according to the standards of the zoning and the setbacks. And I guess that's my point at this point. I mean, I would like to see a little bit of relief for somebody who gets caught in a situation where they just don't have the resources to do this. And it's impossible for them to put this thing together and actually to do what the zoning or what the new setback requirements expect them to do. I mean, I guess that's my concern, and I don't think it's addressed in the bill.
Representative Eastland, I think Mr. Johnson has sent through a lifeline here. Mr. Locksmith, can you shed any light on this issue?
Mr. Chairman, yes. It may help if you changed on line 1.23, deleted as much, replaced it with if, and deleted on 1.24 as possible and inserted practicable. So instead of saying the structure setback must be increased as much as possible, it would say the structure setback must be increased if practicable. That might get to the question that Representative Eastland raised.
Maybe, Mr. Chair, maybe we could take that suggestion, take that lead, and add one thing, if practical and economical.
Representative Nelson, Mr. Lachman.
I guess I would ask Ms. Dyson if practicable changes that in the way that Representative Eastland is asking. I guess that's the question I would have of Ms. Dyson.
Ms. Dyson?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, and Representative Nelson, I'm actually not sure what practicable would include. If it would include the financial burden on the owner as well as the physical ability to move it back. If it's something that needs to be addressed, it might be better to be clear about whether or not that is a consideration the unit of government can take into account.
Well, as the temporary chair, I hate to jump into the middle of this, but Representative Eastland, if that's your intent, maybe what you would want to do is say, if economically practicable. The tongue twister, if I ever saw one.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kale.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Nelson, Representative Eastland. I'm going to vote for the bill, but I want to make sure that that this issue does get resolved. I have some concern about the phrase, but I am going to, for the purposes of putting it before us, going to move that. As was suggested, that on line 1.23, the words as much and line 1.24 as possible be deleted and in their place insert if practicable.
Well, that is the motion before us then. Representative Eastland. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Anytime you put the word economical in there, we're going to have some sort of means testing, because it's economical in different ways to different people. If you're really wealthy, it's economical, but if you're really poor, maybe it isn't. So I think that would be a dangerous path to go down unless we have some sort of percentage of poverty or whatever income guidelines in there.
Sure.
And, of course, that is not part of the current motion. Representative Eastland.
I don't think a person's financial situation has anything to do with it. I mean, I think if you have a house and it burned down and half of it burnt up, it was worth $100,000. If you can replace what's there for $50,000, or if you have to move it, it costs you $100,000. I think the question in my mind is that there's an economic disparity there. And I mean, I think that's the issue that I'm getting at. I mean, I don't care who owns the place or how much money they make or whatever else. I think if it doesn't make sense economically, if we could build it right here and replace it for half of what it would take to move it, I think we should think twice about moving it. If we're going to end up with the same parcel and it's going to be located on the same footprint, and I don't think this language that's proposed here does that. I still don't think it even is clear that even addresses an economic component here, that's part of what practicable means. And so this doesn't get at the root of my concern, I don't think, in solving the issue.
Mr. Chair?
President Nelson?
I would support the Kalin Amendment. The question I have, and this would be for Representative Eastland, would be, you know, insurance. If you have insurance that has full replacement costs, or if you have insurance on that doesn't have full replacement costs, would it ever be economical to replace it? And how could we write that in? I mean, there's raises a lot of issues. I mean, if it's practicable to replace it, or if it's not practical to move it, it could be rebuilt on the same spot. I mean, I think that gets at it. I don't know how we're going to get at that economic. There's a lot of issues there that would open up.
Well, I mean, Mr. Chair, I'm looking at it, and I'm not seeing a clear way to do it either. Otherwise, I would offer some kind of a solution here. But I'm not seeing in the current language structure here that we can do it. But I think it has to do with the disparity between rebuilding on the site, on the footprint, and moving it. And if there's a disparity there, then we should have some way to address that. And if it's a huge disparity for someone to have to move it rather than rebuild on the site, I think that should be a consideration for putting it back on the site. And I don't see a clean, clear, quick way to do that in the language that's written in this bill, but I think it's a concern that I'd like to see cleared up.
Well, members, we do have the motion before us. Ms. Dyson, do you have the motion as proposed by Representative Kalin?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Page 1, line 23, delete as much. Page 1, line 24, delete as possible. And insert if practicable.
That is the motion. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Nelson. Is there any further testifiers for or against the bill?
Mr. Chair, it was just pointed out to me that the same issue, we'd have to make the same amendment on line 3.23 and 3.24 for the cities. The same language is there. So that the same amendment would have to be made in that page.
Right. That's correct, yes. 3.23 and 3.24.
Mr. Chair?
Or 2.4.
It's on page 3.4.
Okay. Right.
Mr. Chair, I'll go ahead and move the, keep my winning streak going, on line 3.24, that as much as possible be deleted, and if practicable, be inserted in its place.
I think everyone understands the amendment. All those in favor of its adoption, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Is there any further discussion to the bill?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to renew my motion that House File 519 be passed and recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations Reform, Technology, and Elections.
Representative Nelson, that would be House File 519 as amended.
As amended, thank you.
Any further discussion to the bill? Seeing none, all those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed to State and Local Government Operations, Technology Reform, and Elections. Thank you.
Next bill on the agenda is
the House file number.
Representative Winkler's bill, House file.
1297.
House file 1297. Mm-hmm. And Representative Winkler, what would you, what would be your pleasure on this bill?
Mr. Chair, we're not going to discuss what my pleasure on this bill would be. Mr. Chair, I would recommend, however, that House File 1297 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations, Reform, Technology, and Elections. I do have a DE2 amendment, Mr. Chair, that I'd like to move to put the bill in the shape I'd like to present it in. So I would move adoption of the DE2 amendment.
So moved. All those in favor of the DE2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The amendment was adopted. Proceed with your bill and as amended and describe your bill. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not the author of this bill because of the long-standing dispute over the townships of St. Louis Park and Golden Valley over property taxes and growth and land management. In fact, that's probably quite the opposite. I do, however, have my own personal background is that this is an annexation bill. I grew up just outside of the city of Bemidji in Bemidji Township, and my grandfather owned a lot of land in that area around lakes and the rivers and so on. My father was a home builder. And he would buy pieces of land and build homes with septic tanks and wells and so on. So a lot of the issues that are part, and it was within a mile or two of the city limits. And so this issue of city services and township growth and rational use of resources is something I've been aware of or been part of my life, I guess, since I was very young. So it's not a completely foreign issue. To me, this dispute over annexation and the long-term ongoing discussion that it has provoked has limited, I would say, statewide policy impact. As a legislature, I think we consider it largely so that we have rational planning and rational use of limited resources and to make sure that the best local decisions that are truly local in nature should be made by those folks there because they're the best ones able to make good decisions. Those, I think, are the two larger principles involved in this issue. I think that this bill, as amended, sets a couple of key definitions that I think help resolve dispute and may be able to allow a lot of areas to better deal with the growth issue. Referring now to the DE2 amendment, Subdivision 13 puts in place a definition of urban or suburban in character at 2.5 units per acre, or 1 unit per 2.5 acres. Sorry, I'm thinking Golden Valley now. 1 unit per 2.5 acres. And this is in reference to, or it's based on a 1995 study that looks at this issue and suggested that that number would be a good starting point for discussion. It also, I think, is helpful because it clears up ongoing dispute and a lack of clear standards because of the contentious nature and relative lack of conformity around this definition, which is used in the contested case hearing process. So that is the first subdivision to discuss. The bill provides for annexation by ordinance where land or where density is of urban or suburban character as defined at one unit per 2.5 acres. The annexation by ordinance requires a 90-day notice. The resolution of consideration by the city must include a comp plan update beforehand so that people, when they are considering this issue and can provide public testimony, are actually going to be looking at something that they can react to rather than just ceding all authority over to a city. And the city also has to make a series of findings, including that the annexation area is contiguous to the municipality's boundaries, that the annexation area is developed according to the urban or suburban density, that the municipality is capable of extending services in a manner consistent with the service plan. And those findings, of course, can be challenged if, for some reason, the city oversteps its boundary. Finally, this bill, as amended now, defines the property tax reimbursement the cities pay to townships for land that's annexed. In year one, they pay 90% of the property taxes distributed to the town in the annexed area. In the second year, it's 80. Third year, it's 60. In the fourth year, it's 40. And in the fifth year, it's 20%. Again, this defines what the payment will be, which I think helps to minimize the disputes that we see. And I think maybe one of the goals here could be that the fewer things that cities and townships have to fight over, maybe the better relations can be formed over time and a more cooperative or less contentious approach to dealing with resources and growth can be reached. That's the bill. I would like to offer some time, I guess, to testifiers who want to present a particular case study in War Road and also to talk about this from the League of Greater Minnesota Cities perspective.
Thank you, and state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bradley Peterson. I'm an attorney with the firm of Flaherty & Hood, and here on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, and I'd like to thank Representative Winkler for bringing this bill. I think this is an issue that is important to discuss. The first thing that I'd like to touch on just briefly is that I know for many of you the fact that we're here with an annexation bill is something of a disappointment. There was a task force process that was put into place starting in 2006. That group, even though I did not serve on it, I worked very closely with the city representatives on that task force. That group met over the course of 14 months, 11 times, for 3 hours apiece. And we went around and around and around on the issues, and we could not get past the one fundamental issue of what is the relative role of townships versus cities when it comes to the facilitating of urban-style development. We started with that question. We ended that with that question, and unfortunately we did not resolve that question, which is why we're here talking to the legislature. Representative Winkler's bill, I think, keys in on three very important issues. The first is this definition of urban or suburban in character, which has been the, I think it is interesting that such an important term in a statute that is a key finding when making decisions is nowhere defined, and so we're hoping to add some definition. As Representative Winkler stated, there was a 1995 report by the Minnesota Planning Agency that attempted to do so. Also, to the enhanced annexation by ordinance, I think Representative Winkler did an excellent job of showing the committee the fact that even though this is something that a city can do on their own, they do need significant public input, and there are significant hurdles that a city would need to clear before they can do that, and hopefully the War Road example will show you exactly what we're trying to accomplish. And then finally, the limitation on reimbursements to townships. In addition to setting out the schedule for annexations by ordinance that Representative Winkler talked about, and which, by the way, is one of the more substantive recommendations of the task force, the legislation also puts limitations on the types of reimbursements that can flow from cities to towns when negotiating orderly annexation agreements. And that part, I want to be absolutely clear, is not a task force recommendation as to orderly annexation agreements. But the concern of cities is that the demands of townships don't bear any relationship to the types of services that might be provided to the area, that serve no public purpose, and at their best serve to frustrate orderly annexation negotiations, and at their worst, either kill a project or development outright or become simply a subsidy from a city or a developer to township taxpayers. And so, Mr. Chair, with that, I will conclude, but I'd like to introduce Mayor Bob Marvin, who is the mayor of the city of War Road.
Please give your name for the tape and then proceed with your testimony.
My name is Bob Marvin. I'm currently the mayor of War Road. Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you for your time. I'm here to share a little bit of our story and what we've had to deal with over the years. I've been the mayor since 94, and since 96 I've been working with city boundaries and trying to expand and develop our community like any other mayor would do for their community. City of War Road is about 1,700 people. Lake Township surrounds, borders War Road on three sides, and it is a minimum of 2,100 people, so it's a greater population. on the fourth side, it's Lake of the Woods, of course, so not an issue there. Lake Township is experiencing growth and development at a much quicker rate than what Warroad is, and the primary reason given in my unofficial survey is the tax base and the tax difference, not the tax base, but the differences in tax between in town and in the township. So as a city, we find that we are, in essence, subsidizing the community at large through our public library, our municipal airport, the various parks that we have, the recreation that's provided, and the facilities, as well as the infrastructure and the improvements that the city has done. Along with that, the city is the primary supporter of the fire department and the facilities that we have there, as well as the paramedics, the ambulances that we have. The disparity in the taxes, if, as an example, there's a $250,000 home. If it was within the city limits, it would be about $1,200 city tax. If it was in the township, it's about $300. So the township is one quarter difference, one quarter of what the city is. So it's a substantial difference, and it makes a difference in our rural area. I believe the committee has a handout labeled Community Profile. And I'd like to point out something that has been an issue for the last, 65, 70 years up in that area. And that is a road called Halberd. And in the handout that's labeled the profile, it has the road identified as item A, and you can clearly see that it is surrounded by the city, north, south, and east side. And the entrance of that road, or the first two blocks of that road, are within the city limits. After that, on the north side of the road, it's township, and on the south side of the road, it's city. Property that's on the west end of that road is being developed, and there are about 9 homes that are going up there that are adjacent to the river and have their own septic systems. The city has got services adjacent to that area as well, and it would have been easy to provide services to that development. But try as we may, we had no luck with the town board, and we had no luck with the county environmental officer trying to explain our position. In addition to that, there is a development about a mile north of the community called Warroad Estates. Warroad Estates is a golf course marina. It is on the shores of Lake of the Woods. There is a minimum of 60 year-round homes, all of which are on a septic system, all of which in the spring of the year with the runoff and the snow melt, the residents experience difficulty with their septic systems based on the saturation point in the ground. About 8 years ago, the city approached the township in serious discussions on annexation. And spent an awful lot of time and numerous meetings with the town board, city representatives, and respective legal counsel. after about 6 years of negotiation back and forth, we came to an impasse. And it wasn't because that there were minor issues to overcome. It was because the town board just wasn't willing to negotiate. And I'll relate this. And I put my neck on the line there a little bit, but after 6 years of negotiating, I figured it was worth a shot. But what we offered the town board was to put in the infrastructure, the sewer system, into the residents of both along Hallberg Avenue and at the Warroad Estates, with the understanding that each household would pay their service connection fees, but the rest of the infrastructure the city would put in at no cost to the residents if the town board would sit down and talk every 5 years about annexation. Not to be annexed, but just sit down and talk about annexation. They turned us down flat out. We're not interested in talking about it anymore. Now, disappointed on one hand, thankful on the other, because I would have had a lot of explaining to do to the city residents had they accepted that. But it was clearly the 6 years a waste of not only our time, but our resources in legal fees, and extremely frustrating.
Mr. Marvin, can you speed up your testimony a little bit?
Well, I'll try.
Yeah.
I'll try. Mr. Chairman, I will. We have a legal avenue in which to proceed, but for a small community, the cost, retainership cost for pursuing a legal annexation was about $40,000, and it literally came down to, do we spend the money on this annexation, or do we take the money and purchase another ambulance? Trade the old one and buy a new one. And we chose the ambulance for our paramedics. It's difficult to proceed with those kind of costs in front of a small community. In the sake of time, I guess I'll leave it there and open to any questions, Mr. Chairman or committee.
Anybody have any questions for the testifiers? Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, I do have questions, but I can wait for others, for all testifiers before. I don't know if Mr. Marvin's the only one that we're expecting.
Representative Winkler, do you have more testifiers for?
Mr. Chair, I don't have any more testifiers personally, no.
Okay.
I'd be surprised if nobody else wanted to talk.
Are there anybody that would like to from the audience like to speak for or against the bill? I see Mr. Sulin coming down, and if you want to identify yourself for the tape, and if we can get through to get another bill we want to get done, so if we can get...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ken Sulum with the Minnesota Association of Townships. I want to give a brief overview of why we are in strong opposition to this bill, even with the delete all amendment. I'll try to keep my comments as short as possible, because I do have some town officers here who would like to give you real life stories of what this bill would mean to them and why it doesn't actually go about to solve any of the problems that have been identified. I think all of you would agree, and I know what I met with Representative Winkler on this bill, that if you're going to pass a bill, it should really be addressed at solving a problem. And it's our position that this bill not only fails to address any problems in a meaningful way, it actually will add fuel to the existing annexation fire and be extremely counterproductive. As you heard, we have had an annexation task force meeting. Regrettably, it came to a stop I think the townships and the cities have a different perspective as to the extent of meaningful discussion we had on some of the substantive issues. I think our members felt that the cities basically said, look, we know we're never going to agree, so let's not waste any more time on having further discussion, and it became apparent we weren't going to be able to get more substantive depth, even though it was clear we wouldn't agree. We did, however, agree to put out a very good report. I believe you'll be getting copies of that shortly, if you haven't already received them. And so we purposely did not put in a bill this year. I understand we had the ability to do that and certainly understand the process. But it was our feeling that the report should be reviewed. It does do a very good job of outlining the substantive issues and the perspectives of both sides. It also puts forth a challenge to the members of the legislature to take some specific steps to say, look, we know we've got vested interests. We know your state representatives and state senators, and perhaps there's a point of view that has not yet been considered. And here are some guiding stepping off points. So we do believe the bill is definitely premature. That said, it also doesn't work. The definition section sounds like a logical, nice, easy thing to do. However, it's also been an issue that for many years has been a discussion between cities and towns, and every time we try to find a definition that works, we fail to come up with one, not because of lack of effort, but because for every provision you put in the bill, there's exceptions. For example, the way this is currently drafted, it says any government service is deemed to be urban. Well, that means that the town hall is now an urban use and would be ripe for annexation. It means the county grader shed is an urban use, ripe for annexation. It does generously address some of the concerns that we've had in the past about things like ethanol plants not being proper for West 7th Street and perhaps being better off in the rural areas. But it's not possible to address every single possible exception, and that's where the definition keeps breaking down. That for every use you can say should be urban, you can find five exceptions to it. And current law tells the ALJ, look, both sides are going to make the argument. You've got the discretion. Who's got the facts for those specific cases? To arbitrarily create a definition simply shifts the fight. It doesn't change the process in any other way. It simply creates a different type of fight that, frankly, just does not work. Another example I could give you are shooting ranges. A couple years ago, we finally reached a compromise on the Shooting Range Protection Act. Well, shooting ranges are a commercial activity, but I don't think most of you who have metropolitan areas would like to see additional shooting ranges in the metro urbanized dense areas. But under this definition, if they generate a tax base, they're commercial, they're ripe for annexation. Section 2 is definitely, by far, the most egregious provision of this bill. Section 2 basically says, landowners, you have absolutely no voice whatsoever. If the city wants it, the city gets it. And I know they try to portray that there's a number of conditions that need to be met, and it's a nice-looking page-and-a-half laundry list of things that have to be done. However, I would disagree respectfully with Mr. Winkler as far as any of the density issues. The only thing that refers to density is after it's been annexed. It cannot allow residential densities that are less than what's already existing within the municipality. It's not a set density. It's whatever exists within that city. Well, that's going to differ from community to community. So it's not getting at any kind of real density issue or solving any particular problem. But what it does say is, if you don't want to be in the city and you have no desire to be in the city, even if it's not yet developed, I know they gave you the example of the War Road situation, but even if it's farmland, if the city decides that's where we think we want to be, you heard that their example, the county environment officer said the sewer wasn't the appropriate approach, but nonetheless, we get to take it if we have a plan. Now, the plan does say that they must have a process for extending services, doesn't set a definite timeline, doesn't take into account many of the issues you were just debating in the last bill. There's nothing in here that talks about the cost factor. I think you'll hear from some of my testifiers about the expense of extending services in the Rochester area. None of that is addressed by this bill. Again, there is a process in place that if a city wants to annex and they can make a legitimate case, they can go forward. Is it expensive? Yes. Can we try to find ways to lessen the cost?
We've tried, we're exploring options, but the reality is, under current systems or any system that's going to take into account both sides, you're going to have a review process, and that's going to cost money. And right now, this would simply say there's one perspective that matters, and that's the city's perspective, not the landowner's perspective, not the impact to the township, not the impact to what it does to neighboring properties, not the impact it does to farmland. What the city wants, the city gets. The last section, section 3, on the reimbursement, the cities would have you believe that this has been a huge barrier to negotiating orderly annexation agreements. The statistics simply do not bear that out. There are approximately 12, maybe 15 OAs that have had this provision added to it. Several of them came about by the developer's request, saying, if I'm willing to pay this, can we facilitate the process? If this works as a way of breaking the juggernaut between the city and the town, because the city isn't willing to negotiate on tax base, can we do something? Is it an approach that we advocate from our association? No. We talk about multiple ways of looking at issues. But it's not a one-size-fits-all. It is simply a matter of how do you negotiate, what are the options? The city can say no and come back with a counteroffer. The city could say, look, we're not willing to pay the per-acreage fees. However, the city of Northfield, 30-some years ago, negotiated an agreement with the Waterford Township to do a reimbursement that is based on a percentage of what the city gets. And it takes into account the fact that property values most of the time increase. We're in a bit of a recession right now, but most of the time you're going to see property values increasing, you're going to see the cost of township services increasing. And so if you have a process that allows the reimbursement to be mutually negotiated and increased proportionately, it works. If it works to say we're going to pay per acre, then it works. We don't want to arbitrarily cut off the ability to negotiate. These are mutually agreed upon things, not forced. You could say it removes the barrier. Well, what it really says is this is what you get, take it or leave it. I suppose you could say that streamlines negotiations, but it's negotiating with a gun to your head, and that's simply not a good process. I don't think Representative Winkler would like to see that any of his legal issues in negotiating if the other side says this is all you get. Exactly. If you're the side holding the gun, great. If you're not, you don't want to take it. So it's not an effective way to facilitate negotiations. With that, I'm going to turn it over to my testifiers, and then I do have just a couple quick sentences to wrap up.
Okay. Please identify yourself for the tape and then proceed with your statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Gary Peterson from Dover, Minnesota. I am a township officer, and I also sat on the annexation task force that you had appointed. I think Kent did a good job wrapping up the technical part of the bill. I'm going to testify how I think this would affect some farmers in our areas and how it would restrict them from any future development and allowing children and that type of thing to get into farm operations. The total package of this bill being sought and being pitched as ways started out as to reduce greenhouse emissions, reduce miles traveled by promoting denser development and closer to cities. When carefully reviewed, however, the bill turns out to be pieces of legislation that would result in taking zoning authority away from both townships and counties and likely promote annexation. As introduced, the bill would require comprehensive plans to concentrate new residential development in cities, in the city's established growth area, if any, or buildable lands adjacent to the cities, and that could be subject to annexation and the extension of municipal services. The legislation does not address any residential growth areas in townships, period. And if the unincorporated area has a residential density greater than one residential unit per 40 acres, as of August 1st, 2009, the density never be increased unless brought into the city. Just think how this would impact our farmers trying to set up a child in a farm operation and allowing them to construct another dwelling. The bill would also give the city exclusive right to plan, adopt, and enforce official control in its growth area, which may be of any size, and location anywhere the city wants outside the city boundaries. Okay. Kent said that part had been removed.
Yeah, I was checking myself. Yeah.
My apologies.
That's okay.
If this bill is passed, it would restrict all the townships from developing in residential areas. And again, one of the other things that I wanted to really hit on is being a member of the task force. I would ask that you wait and take a look at our recommendations from that task force. You're going to see that we do have quite a bit in there about joint planning idea. Sure, cities and townships, we couldn't get together on the final, you know, what's going to make this thing work. But we do feel that joint planning is the key to this thing, and that's what I would promote. This bill definitely does not promote joint planning. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. And there was another testifier. If you please state your name for the tape and be concise as possible and state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jeffrey Holm. I'm a township supervisor in Baldwin Township up in Sherburne County. And we're south of the city of Princeton. And over the years, we've had annexation take place there. One of my concerns here is our commercial district borders the city of Princeton. And, what one of my fears are is, you know, what kind of a burden would shift on the residential property owners with the loss of that. Princeton has been making many designs on this. To get to the point here, we've been looking at ideas of consolidation, but I'm afraid some of these bills this year, hiding behind the disguise of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, would take away some of the tools for us to decide at a local level, cooperating with the city and township together, figuring out what means to, you know, facilitate any annexation or possible consolidations. I just want to reiterate that I would like to keep the things the way they are. We're doing well working with it. We have good cooperation with the city of Princeton as it is right now. And I'm afraid that these possible growth boundaries, growth areas, would bring some undue hardship to some property owners who are going to be years and years away from what the market could actually facilitate. So the city just took a loan out for $20 million to triple the size of their sewer plant, and I don't think the market's going to bring construction out a couple miles from town, but yet if the city moves forward with some of their plans they have, it could be detrimental to their ability to properly your process. So, thank you.
Sir, can you identify yourself for the tape and then proceed with your testimony?
Sure. My name is Lenny Lawrence. I'm Township Officer in Cascade Township, Olmsted County. I have about a little over 3,000 citizens that live in the township. We are an urban township of nature. The county ordinance states that a minimum of 2 acres for our subdivision. That said, that number came from a nitrate loading having to do with septics, and that's why we have a minimum lot size of that 2 acres. That's where the arbitrary number came from. Our residents enjoy a different standard of government or a different style of government than what they would get underneath the city. They like the more lower profile areas of the way it happens. We just had our annual meetings. They vote on our budget. If they don't like an item in the budget, we strike it. They say we don't have to buy that. We don't need that new truck this year. And that's a resident's choice on that. The other thing I got to express on this is when our planning and zoning, we try to make sure that we have sustainable stuff. We don't use the ag land areas. We use rougher lands, stuff that is a little bit harder to develop. It's not crop land, it's productive. Therefore, the 2 acre minimum lot size is proven to be a good thing, a good tool. We leave a smaller footprint. We don't disturb every square inch of the land like a city development would. And when these subdivisions are annexed, you would think you would look for infill on there and the city would extend the services. Up till now, we had a big annexation in Rochester Township, and it took one-third of their population. up till now, not one of those houses that I'm aware of has got new city services. We still use, the only thing that changed in that annexation was the fact that they went from the sheriff's department policing it, now they have city police. We still have the same fire department, the same municipal services. And it is in Rochester's opinion, at that lot size, that they can replace those septic systems if those other services aren't available. It's sometimes cost prohibitive to put those services through those karst geologies down there. And as long as we have septic available, there's no benefit to the homeowner. However, in the Rochester defense, part of those areas were surrounded, you know, as part of the annexation. But the other thing I got to say is what's happening when you put so much restrictions in an area, you tend to start forcing the people to the cheaper spot outside of the cities. And what's happening in Olmsted County is we're seeing a donut effect in Dodge County, Fillmore County, Goodhue, where this development is being pushed off to, not necessarily in the city of Rochester. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for your testimony. Could you quickly wrap it up here and give your name for the tape and then give your testimony. You can be concise so we can get it wrapped up. I'd like to get questions from the committee and so we can get votes for this.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the opportunity to appear before your committee. My name is Don Scherper, and I'm with the township. I'm a supervisor in Livonia Township, Sherburne County. What I would like to concentrate on are just a few suggestions that might ease some of the tensions between the cities and the townships. So, first of all, I would like to say that I think it behooves the legislature to become familiar with the final report on the Municipal Boundary Task Force. This presents both the city and the township's positions on annexation reform viewpoints. I think it's mighty important that you review those and see where they are. After all, the task force spent 18 months approximately meeting several times over that period of time to agree on where we could. Secondly, the state needs to have a neutral policy which allows for a merger, annexation, or consolidation initiated by the residents of the affected area. No longer should this be driven by the state, urban policy institutes, or special interests that may benefit directly. Thirdly, the state should strengthen education, outreach, and technical assistance for land use planning, comprehensive planning, and land use ordinances. Fourth, incentives and resources need to be provided to prompt both the cities and the townships to voluntarily consider and discuss consolidation. Fifth, intergovernmental cooperation examples should be promoted by the state as best practices for the communities around the state to emulate. And suburbanization in many instances is pejoratively called sprawl, which has a negative connotation. Sprawl is really suburbanization of the city. Many people will relocate for lower taxes, generally less crime and better schools. Lower taxes, generally less crime and better schools to an affordable home with a larger lot, provided they will have reasonable transportation and resources. Sprawl is bad, but growth is good. But really, what's the difference? The bottom line should be freedom of choice, and why shouldn't people have the right to live within the type of local government that they choose? And I strongly urge rejection of HF 1297 by this committee. Thank you.
Mr. Stolen, if you want to wrap up quickly, and then I have another testifier, and then I'd like to get Mr. Johnson, or Mr. Peterson, and Mr. Stolen down here so we can ask questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think in closing, what we want to leave with is we agree good planning is important, but there is absolutely nothing in this bill before you that addresses planning from a cooperative perspective or that even requires that any particular goal or achievement is met. If this bill does not pass, there is not a single city that will be harmed. Things will stay status quo. It'll give time for you as members to review the task force report. It'll give time for us to try to develop some further discussions. We are currently negotiating with the, or I should, negotiating is probably a little too strong at this early of a phase, but we are currently in discussions with the Association of Minnesota Counties about how can we revisit the Community-Based Planning Act, how can we revisit cooperative efforts and create better incentives. Things that were tossed out at the task force meetings were things like, at a certain density level, when should we have connecting pipes put in at the time of construction so that if sewer and water does come forward, there isn't cost of retrofitting. All these ideas are things that are out there right now and being discussed. This bill would create a disincentive to have any cooperation, to continue any discussions, and we ask for your rejection on this bill. Thank you.
Mr. Johnson, if you'd like to speak.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. I can be very brief, as I know you've got some questions to still ask. The League of Minnesota Cities does support the Delete All Amendment and Representative Winkler's bill, that it would be in that form. This is obviously a big issue for cities. The League of Minnesota Cities policies do reflect these three provisions that we define urban and suburban in character. It is one of the core items used to make decisions about whether an annexation is appropriate, and there is no definition in statute. This is needed. The conditions around which we streamline the annexation process are the second provisions in the bill. We do need to streamline these processes. They are incredibly cumbersome and incredibly difficult. We're hoping that this is a way to approach it. And finally, Mr. Chair, the final provisions of this bill are fiscal. They are not an attempt to put a gun to anyone's head. They're an attempt to make it very clear what costs should be considered and in what manner. The formula that you see, there used to be a formula in statute in the earlier annexation provisions in an attempt to make it clear we're okay with people negotiating out other solutions to this problem. The formula was taken out. What we ended up with is lots of people who said, but what's an acceptable solution? We don't know what one is. And this formula was the option that they used to be able to go to as what the acceptable formula was. The other charges referred to in the final provision are acreage fees that are not for a service. They're not for an assessment that's being abandoned. They're not for stranded costs that the local unit of government is facing during an annexation. They're simply an added cost that's being added to get cooperation in an annexation. And we really don't feel that that's an appropriate role for two governments to be playing with each other, is to say, if you give us cash, that we'll negotiate nicer. I think this is a good government fix. It does not approach the joint planning, the broad planning that we need to do. This is the technical pieces of the bill. There's another bill that's being discussed and broad discussions going on about how do we do the bigger philosophical discussion on annexation policy, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. As Mr. Sulem and Mr. Peterson would come down, I have Representative Kalin. Do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I had contemplated moving the table of the bill, but I think I'll let the ultimate vote on the bill suffice for that motion. I'd also contemplated deleting everything but Section 1, but because I think that's the piece that I think from a township perspective, I know that Mr. Sulem might disagree with me, having been through the Chisago City, Wyoming multiple round annexation debate, it was this lack of definition. I think there was a lot of time, frankly, I don't want to say wasted, but not spent well because of this lack of definition. But I do think that that there's a question, there's a phrase that appears twice, the actual or planned, in reference to the density issue, and frankly, I think that the term ends up muddying what I think the desire of what Mr. Peterson's desire in the bill is, and I asked staff, and I don't know that we've got any clarification there, so I'm wondering if Mr. Peterson might tell us on line 1.6 the impact of the term actual or planned, and what the impact would be if that phrase disappeared.
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, I think the actual or planned addresses two things. Planning for the putting in of infrastructure on the front end, and then dealing with problems such as you have in War Road once the development is actually there and you have to go back in and contemplate the retrofit of services. And so, you know, there are a lot of communities around the state that have a lot of experience with this, and since Olmsted County and Rochester were raised, over the last several years, the city of Rochester has spent $22 million of their local option sales tax, not something that many communities have the luxury of, to retrofit sewer and water services into townships east of the city. There were 1,500 homes with septic tanks around the city of Rochester, and many of these were failing terribly, and they were on very small lots, very low-income people. And so the city subsidized to the tune of $15,000 per household the putting in of infrastructure. And so what you see there is that you want to be ahead of the game. And so when you plan something, that should trigger some conversation about how do you put those infrastructure pieces in. And also, too, then you have the actual piece which says, well, now if we need to put infrastructure in, what do we need to do? Or merely recognize the fact that there are the vitality of communities like War Road are being sapped because not everybody who is part of that community is paying into the tax base, and that the vitality of that community relies on a strong tax base.
Mr. Cole, you have a response?
Mr. Chair, yes. Two points, I guess, that I'll hit. One is with regard to the Rochester situation that Mr. Peterson just summarized. During the task force discussions, it was admitted by the City of Rochester's delegate that that situation was dealing with a subdivision that was pre-World War II, largely construction, and that, in fact, that development occurred when there was no city planning, no township planning, no county planning, and in all likelihood would not be built today. So we acknowledge that, yes, there definitely were some problems that needed to be cleaned up, but it was not brought about by any particular action. And in fact, the township supported the optional sales tax and pay into that whenever they are shopping in Rochester. As far as the planned residential or other issues that are listed in Subdivision 13, some of you are very familiar with the recent incorporation of the City of Columbus that used to be Columbus Township. And that's a situation where the township was doing planning and zoning for about 30-some years. They had some development that was looking at putting in a commercial industrial site. The township, not the city, worked with the developers, developed the proper comp plan, invested all of the money to put out the sewer and water lines that were necessary. After all the work was done, then the city of Forest Lake came and said, well, gee, now that there's $12.5 million of raw tax value sitting out there, we'd be happy to annex that property and take it off your hands. Under this bill, because the township did the planning, because the township put the infrastructure in, because the township did what they should be doing for good planning, the city would have been rewarded. The ALJ in that case actually found that the only thing Forest Lake offered was taking the taxes and increasing the taxes for what was would have been left of the township. So, again, we support good planning. So good planning can be done by townships. Bad planning can be done by townships. Good planning can be done by cities. Bad planning can be done by cities. What we need to do is not have a one-size-fits-all answer that destroys incentives to work together, that does not recognize when a township does do good planning.
Kalin, Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I didn't, I'm not going to offer the amendment that would take out the phrase just to tell Representative Winkler if this bill advances. I think that phrase, actual or planned, where it shows up twice, actually makes things much worse and allows a comprehensive plan sitting on a shelf to be the determining factor, not zoning. And so I mean, I don't like the definition that's in here. I think it needs a lot more work. I definitely don't like the rest of the bill, but I do think that actual or planned ends up making a much bad situation worse rather than better. And I think all of our communities should be moving to zoning ordinances after adopting comprehensive plans right away, and getting rid of that phrase would help to encourage that speed.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to commend Representative Winkler for being brave soul to take this bill on. There's a long history here, and it sounds like the issues are still on the raw and on the surface. But I have some concerns about the bill. I live in a township. I live in a township that's bordered by two cities. We can talk about Columbus Township. We can talk about Lake Township and Warroad. There are some places around that are struggling with how to get along and how to work together. But there are also some places that are doing fine. There's also townships and cities that are working together, and that are making this process work. Now, I don't know what the difference is, but I think it would behoove us to try and find out how it can work well in some areas and not well in others. But I guess what I'm concerned about in the bill, first of all, I applaud anybody who is willing to take this on. And I mean the authors of the bill and whoever is supporting it, I think there's valid concerns here that you're trying to address. And I think it's really bringing them up for discussion. And I think the whole annexation issue is important. But what I'm concerned about in the bill is that you have to get to the bottom of the second page before you even hear the word town. And it's the top of the third page. It's in that we're talking about. And it's only when it comes to notice for a public hearing. And I don't see much of any mention in here except on the top of the third page there, I think, line 3.2, where it talks about the property owners. And I mean, I just think that's insulting. I think it's insulting that we can write a bill and assume that we can just write off property owners and one unit of government that's existed for years and years and years and has been very, very effective. And I mean, and the needs of Lake Township are a lot different than the needs of a township between Greenbush and Roseau. And the point is that there is not a one-size-fits-all here. And the issues that are being pointed out, I think, are valuable, but I don't think they are providing a reasonable solution at all. I'm concerned about the language Representative Kalin brought up, and actually there's another point where it's in the bill, and it just isn't exactly the same terminology, but it's on line 313, where it says the proposed annexation area is developed or is planned to be developed. I mean, I don't know what it means to be planned to be developed. It says basically what I read this as saying is a municipality can decide that they want to extend their comprehensive plan and they want to lasso an area out here and say we're going to make this high density residential and we're going to make this area over here commercial industrial, and now because we have a plan that's where it's going to go, we can annex it. Township doesn't have anything to say about it. Landowners have nothing to say about it. That seems to me to be a little bit unfair. I mean, I understand the need for cities to be able to grow and control some of their own destiny, but I mean, there's no limitations on this. None. There's no acreage limitations. There's no time limitations. There's no limitations on this. I think that's just a little bit unreasonable. And then I guess the final concern that I have is when I look at the process for annexation here, and at the end it says, in number 6, line 3.10, it says, after the public hearing and before enacting an annexation ordinance under this paragraph, the governing body of the municipality must make the following findings. So the governing body, the city, makes the findings. They decide they want to annex it, they go through the comprehensive plan process, and then they decide if it's contiguous, if it's developed or planned to be developed, and if we're capable of extending services, that's the criteria. I guess my question is, I mean, what if I'm a landowner in the middle of all this and I don't want to be annexed? I don't want my farm to become a housing development. That's not my plan. Do I have something to say about that? I just don't understand why the mentality is here is that there aren't some limitations on this. I can understand why you're going down this road, but put some reasonable limitations on this so that everybody knows what this means. I mean, are we taking 40 acres at a time? Do we have to provide services there before we move any farther? I don't know. But I think there's some ground in between what you're suggesting here and where we are now that really hasn't been explored. And I'm just having a very difficult time seeing how this really solves any problems at all. I think it's going to create a lot more hostility and a lot more concern among the landowners and the townships and the town boards that are out there that are going to all of a sudden be looking at no options. And I would be concerned. And what you do with a bill like this is you put a person like me in a no-win situation. I've got cities, I've got townships. This is not a good solution. If I vote for it, I'll have the cities on my side. If I vote against it, I'll have the townships on my side. That's not what I'm here for. I'm not here to create winners and losers. I'm here to solve problems. This does not solve the problem.
Representative Turner.
Okay, just had a couple of questions, and I just make a comment. I come, you know, from the city of Rosemont, and I border three cities that are 20,000 and above, and I also border two townships and a small city under 200 people. And I've been kind of working on some of these issues, and I haven't quite got to the bottom of it. I finally got the task force report about 10 minutes after the meeting started here, and it looks like there's some things in there I'd like to look at, but I've got kind of questions that I don't know if I can come to a positive vote here today. But some of my questions were like on the 2 acres versus 2.5 acres, if either one of you would, if that would be enough to make a change pro on that one. And then also just a goal, like what is the goals and the purpose of townships in that? I mean, that was, they look forward in a 20-year plan and such.
Mr. Stolen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Turner, obviously what we're trying to promote at the Township Association, and I think you've heard voiced by some of the witnesses, is townships is a form of government. It's a chance for the people to have very direct input on the services they want, the services they don't want, tax and vote on their levy. Our goal as an association is to make sure our members go forth in a very good manner. We don't want townships out there being bad actors. We don't want them condoning bad development practices. As far as 2 acres versus 2.5 acres, I believe, and I could be corrected, I think 2.5 acres is currently the minimum lot size for septic systems. I won't swear to that. And so at a certain point, we acknowledge that individual treatment systems are not a viable option. However, just about every environmental group that's ever studied the difference, including the University of Minnesota and PCA, has concluded that, when possible, septics and alternative treatments are a better environmental option to big pipe sewer. So there are ways of handling it through cluster systems, shared drain fields. One of the things you didn't get a chance to hear in the Rochester area is that they had another subdivision where they solved the problems by having a community drain field that is 3 times the size required by PCA standards. They alternate which segment of the field is being used, so that every year it's cycled. The soils are allowed to dry out. There are many different options of looking at things, and that's where we're trying to get the conversations to go. I admit I am not a specialist in that field, but that's where we're trying to work with the counties and interested city groups, interested environmental groups, to say, how do we do good planning and what services meet what needs? And so that's the goal and objective of our association, is to preserve the right of townships to exist as a form of government and to provide those needs.
Thank you. Representative Beard was on the list, but I don't see him right here.
Mr. Chair, may I respond to Representative Eastland's comments?
Go ahead, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, I appreciate your concerns about towns and property owners, and I think The flat answer to property owners is, if a property owner does not want to sell their land for development, they don't have to. Just because they are adjacent to a city, but they want to continue farming, nothing in this bill would prevent them from doing so. And secondly, you know, to your issue about could the city simply, in their comprehensive plan, extend their growth area, or extend, say they want to do planning for the unincorporated area and use that as a pretext to do this type of annexation. That's certainly not our intent, and you know, I think that's language that certainly could be clarified, because that is not our intent for cities with this bill, to go out and say, you know, we are going to plan this area, and oops, since it's being planned, we'd like to now annex it. Now, the bill that did pass out of here a couple of weeks ago, the Representative Hosh bill, did address this area, or did address this issue of growth areas and the type of things that, in the big picture, I think from a planning perspective, we do need to be discussing. But I think the status quo is no longer acceptable. The tax inequities between townships and residents, when you're talking about how do you support the vitality of a community like War Road, it's not acceptable. When the legislature is trying to encourage communities to be as efficient as possible, it's not acceptable for the legislature to not give cities tools to be as vital as they can be. And I believe Mr. Johnson mentioned the fact that if you have these cities and communities that are vital and can provide for themselves because they have a strong tax base, you decrease their reliance on LGA. And so the context of this bill is in the context that we live. The state has an annexation statute. The state in the findings of the lead of Chapter 414, and I know there is not a lot of popularity around legislative findings, but we do have them because, frankly, they are the only clear expression of legislative intent when it comes to these issues. The law that backs up those findings is ambiguous. And the reason that townships and cities fight a lot is because we've been left with a lot to fight about because the legislature has not been clear. Now, this bill may not be a perfect expression of what ought to happen, but I think if the legislature is going to be serious about addressing some of these problems, eventually the legislature is going to need to come to the realization that at times cities and townships are not necessarily going to get along, and at that point somebody needs to be invested with the ability to implement the state's objectives and policies regarding how communities grow. And that's the question that ultimately, whether it's through this bill this year or next year or the year after that or 10 years from now, the legislature is going to have to deal with this. But I hope that the legislature deals with it soon because, frankly, I don't want to be 60 years old sitting across from a 70-year-old Kent Sulem arguing about these issues.
Mr. Chair,
I see a lot of delaying this going on. We need to get to a vote here, and going back and forth here, and so we'll see if there's any more questions. If there aren't any more questions here from the members of the committee, let's proceed to a vote.
So, Mr. Chair, I would renew my motion that House File 1297 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the committee on
as amended
to state and local government operations, reform, technology, and elections.
We hear the motion. All in favor of the bill, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Division, Mr. Chair.
All those in favor, please raise your hand. Opposed? The ayes have it. Motion passed. The bill was passed. Motion prevails. The bill was passed. Three. The next bill on the agenda for today is House File 898, Representative Hornstein. Representative Hornstein, do you have
Mr. Chair.
Motion that you'd like to make?
Yes, I'd move that House File 898 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations, Reform, Technology, and Elections. And, Mr. Chair, I do have two amendments, actually.
Okay.
And these would be amendments to get the bill in its proper form. So I would move the DE-9 and the A1 amendment. I don't know. That's two separate motions.
Yeah,
okay, so first motion would be to move the DE-9 amendment.
So moved. Well, all in favor of the DE9?
Yeah.
You want to incorporate the A1 into the DE9?
Yeah.
Okay, you want to, and House, or you want to move the 98A1 amendment to incorporate it into the DE9 amendment?
Correct.
Okay. So, we don't need to vote on that. Okay. Okay. So, the motion is to the DE9 amendment as amended?
Correct.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Want to proceed to...
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is the non-controversial bill of the evening. So, I appreciate your hearing the bill. Members, this is a bill to respond to a number of issues. It comes out of the climate change advisory group that was appointed by the governor as a result of legislative action last year. And one of the conclusions that this commission arrived at was that in order to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and for the state to reach its goals in that area would be to take some action to reduce the vehicle miles traveled in our state and region. One of the best ways to accomplish that are through some of the changes contemplated in this bill related to primarily the comprehensive planning process, but also some issues related to environmental review. So this bill has three goals. One is to, first and foremost, implement these important recommendations of this commission, and secondly, address the issue of the role of transportation in land use and reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. Transportation accounts for 25% of total carbon greenhouse gas emissions emitted in Minnesota. And the third goal is when we reduce greenhouse gases, we also accomplish another very important public policy goal, which I think is shared by most, if not all, members of the legislature and the governor, and that's to reduce our dependence on foreign oil and our oil dependence on oil in general. Just in the last year alone, we spent $519 billion, in fact, exported that amount of money overseas to support our oil habit, and that's far too much. It's a huge amount of money, and this bill accomplishes that public policy goal as well. So I'll quickly go through the sections, and I do have a couple of testifiers as well. But I'll, again, go through the bill very quickly, and then the committee can ask questions.
And Representative Hornstein, I've got a note here that says the bill, the parts of the bill that pertain to our committee would be 3, 7 through 15. Yeah, 7, 3 and 7 through 15.
Okay, well, then that will certainly help us move us along.
16 and 17 have fiscal implications, which we don't deal with here, and so
okay.
We can, if you can keep your testimony to that, we can move it along a little quicker.
Did you say sections 3?
3, 7, and 3, then 7 through 15.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that direction. We envision that municipalities will need some technical assistance in implementing some of the policies in the bill, so we have a grant program that's described in Section 3. Section 7 is a... hang on just one second here. Is the... comes out of that governor's climate change advisory group, and it relates, as I referenced earlier, to the interest in reducing vehicle miles traveled, so we define that and have a reduction goal. In Section 8, of course, is the definition. Section 9 relates to the comprehensive planning process that is undergone by many communities in the state, and I just want to at this point publicly thank the representatives from the League of Minnesota Cities as well as counties that have worked with us on this legislation. They had a number of concerns in this bill before it was amended, and I hope that we have addressed many of those. So we are, again, relating this to the comprehensive planning process. This is a pretty important part of the bill, members and Mr. Chair. Then we move on to, again, looking at some additional technical assistance for counties and cities and counties through the Livable Communities program. Also include that as you know, part of the overall program that's envisioned by the Metropolitan Council. This is I think was enacted by the legislature in the late 90s. And then just some technical issues around review and comments for the comprehensive planning process, which just you know, update some timelines and other issues that are already in statute. So I think that pretty much does it, Mr. Chair. Oh, we have finally in 16 and 17, this is again the need for technical assistance and funding to cities in order to implement the changes, particularly in the comprehensive planning process envisioned in the bill. We have we have engaged the University of Minnesota Center for Transportation Studies to provide that technical assistance, and so we are looking at the fiscal impacts of that and have a source of the money, and that would be the Livable Communities Grant Program of the Metropolitan Council. So that's outlined in Sections 16 and 17. So that should do it in terms of the bill, Mr. Chair.
And 16 and 17, again, are not in our purview, not a finance committee, but...
But I just want to assure them that you, Mr. Chair, and members, that where we have envisioned costs, we have identified funding sources.
Thank you. Do you have a testifier here?
Yes, this is Mr. John Bailey from 1,000 Friends of Minnesota, and he's also been working closely with the Minnesota Environmental Partnership on this bill.
Mr. Bailey, would you like to speak? Give your name for the tape, and then you'd proceed with your testimony.
Yes, good afternoon or good evening, committee, Mr. Chair. My name is John Bailey. I'm with 1,000 Friends of Minnesota. 1,000 Friends of Minnesota is a statewide membership organization promoting a better way to grow in communities all around the state. We're also, as Representative Hornstein alluded to, this is also one of the priority issues of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. It's a coalition of over 80 environmental organizations located throughout the state of Minnesota, representing over 450,000 Minnesotans. If I had to take a quick step back, tell you why 1,000 Friends of Minnesota has been working on this bill, in addition to the other MEP membership organizations. And also go into a little bit more detail into some of the language that Representative Hornstein alluded to. You know, first of all, you know, what this bill is about is really how we can incorporate, how we can add 1.3 million new people in a way that sustains our environment, increases our competitiveness, and adds value to our communities. When we think about planning, we need to really look at the trends leading up into the future. And we believe that the Minnesota in the future will look different than the Minnesota of the past. For instance, like the rest of the country, the senior population is the fastest growing segment of the population. Demographers refer to this as the silver tsunami. By 2020, there will be more people over 65 than in K-12 education. To put this in perspective, in 1960, just about 50% of households were two parents or children, and now that is only 23% of households. Additionally, families are having fewer children, younger people are staying single longer, and a growing number of households are choosing to not have children at all. I mention all this because this change in demographics is shifting consumer preferences towards communities where people have greater choices in where they live and how they move around. And I want to be clear, this doesn't mean that we're going to stop driving and stop living in single-family homes. I myself have been known to drive quite a lot. Now that I have two children, I drive more than ever thought possible. That's going to be a big part of our future as well. But it's not only going to be driving. It's not only going to be single-family homes. It's going to be places where people can drive, but you can also walk, bike, and take transit as well. The crux of the issue is that we have built communities over the last half century that have given us little choice. They have largely required driving for just about every trip, getting a gallon of milk, dropping off the kids at school, even going to the neighborhood park. In fact, while we often think of our commute to work when we think about traffic and congestion, that is only 15% of our trips. 85% of our trips are for these daily errands I was talking about before, and that is a function of our land use. So I want to go into a little bit more details into the bill, and again, just the bill, the sections of the bill that the committee has jurisdiction over. Because how does this bill we're talking about today move us in the direction of providing more choices and options while also helping us meet our energy security and greenhouse gas reduction goals? First of all, the comprehensive planning changes that were alluded to, sections really 9 through 15. This asks the Met Council to adopt a policy statement that would set a per capita reduction in vehicle miles traveled, VMT. That's just the term planners use when we talk about the amount of driving that we all do. And it's important to note here, because this gets lost in discussion, this is a per capita reduction. Obviously, we're not looking towards this flat statewide ban, because that would be silly, of course. That wouldn't take into account economic development, job growth, just the population growth as well. This is talking about a per capita reduction in VMT over time. A couple things to note about that goal. First of all, it's a regional goal. It doesn't mean that every community all around the Met Council area is going to achieve this reduction in per capita VMT. Some communities will be more, some communities do less, but we're asking the Met Council to make this a regional goal over time. We're not looking for a cookie-cutter approach. What happens in Lakeville, what happens in Woodbury, what happens in Minneapolis is all going to look very, very different. But as a regional approach, we need to achieve that regional per capita VMT goal. It's also performance-based. We're not looking to micromanage how communities, how cities and counties and townships do this. We're just looking for the performance-based goal. There's a variety of ways, and we're going to be going, I'll get to this in a minute, but to the University of Minnesota developing the category and the system and the clearinghouse for how this can be done. It's definitely not rocket science. It's being done all over the country, and it's being done in Minnesota as well. And it's also important to note, this is not just about transit. Transit is obviously a key part of the puzzle, but an interesting study came out last year from the Urban Land Institute. That's a real estate research institution referred to as growing cooler. And that showed that just a mix of uses, more pedestrian-friendly design, you know, those kind of just basic land use changes can actually achieve about a 20 to 40% reduction in driving. And so transit will be a huge part of that, but it's not the only part. We can get a lot of the way there through changes in land use, making it easier to walk and bike as well, in addition to the important investments in transit. Secondly, and this is the compromise we came to with the cities and the counties as well, these are the new comp plans that we would do in 2015. For those of y'all that don't know, you know, the challenge we have is the MTAG report that President Hornstein alluded to talked about making these changes right now. Well, the challenge is that the changes, the comp plan changes, were already due just last year in 2008. So we don't ask people to start in 2009, start the comp planning changes again. What we had thought made sense was doing kind of a mid-course correction in 2013, but in our discussions with the cities and the counties, that didn't make sense either. So we've gone to kind of starting the process over again in 2015. And this really makes a heck of a lot of sense for a lot of reasons regarding good government and public policy. It's never really made sense to do this sort of on the 8th, on the 1998, 2008, 2018. The census data is really so stale at that point. I think a lot of people have suggested, for a lot of reasons, it really makes sense to do this a little bit earlier in the decade so you can use the most up-to-date census data when you do your planning. And finally, just the partnership with the University of Minnesota as well to provide a lot of the tools, resources, and resource sharing needed to help communities meet this VMT goal. A couple of other issues as well. There's school siting. Well, I won't go into that because that's not under your jurisdiction. So I'll just kind of move on from there. You know, I think Representative Hornstein alluded to the energy security and the greenhouse gas reduction goals as well. I'd mention a couple of other co-benefits in addition to those. First of all, public infrastructure cost savings. More compact communities cost the public sector far less in the long term than more spread out communities through more efficient use of infrastructure. According to a Metropolitan Council study, a more compact development form, which would give people the opportunity to walk more, rely more on transit, and generally drive shorter distances, could save $3 billion in infrastructure costs over 20 years. Secondly, personal transportation costs. This is intuitive, but it really bears repeating when we think of our current economic condition. Transportation has been steadily grabbing a larger share of household budgets. It is now the second largest expense behind only a mortgage. This burden is obviously far greater in communities with little transportation choices and will only be exacerbated by rising fuel prices. This is why most people that deal in workforce housing recognize access to transportation as integral to any meaningful definition of affordability. You know, in conclusion, at the beginning of my testimony, I mentioned the projected growth in Minnesota's population. I want to leave you with a final statistic that I think is, some people find quite frightening, but I think it's actually quite hopeful. And that said, 50% of the development on the ground by 2050 will be built between now and then. This provides an enormous opportunity for us to rethink the public and private costs of our transportation investments and our land use policies. What this bill does is set the policy framework moving forward that is informed by the emerging new realities of rising and erratic energy prices, climate change, and changing demographics and shifting consumer preferences. Thank you.
Okay. Questions? Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, I'm kind of confused by the language in Section 3. In line 2.28, the Environmental Quality Board shall make grants to local units of government for changes in municipal ordinances. Let's just stop there. I mean, somehow it doesn't seem to me to be that's what you mean. There isn't really any connection in the way this is worded that connects the grant to the goal. It just says you'll make grants for changes in municipal ordinances. And it's not clear to me why municipal ordinances have anything to do with meeting those goals in the first place, but I think the language here just doesn't work.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilpe, I think you've correctly identified an issue with this in terms of how it's worded, and we will, I think, need to make a change in this section. I think the intent here is that we want to provide some technical assistance to help, to help these local units of government, address, how they can make the needed changes in their, policies to conform with the intent of the legislation. I can have Mr. Bailey maybe expound upon it, but you're absolutely correct, Representative Hilty, in how this is worded. I appreciate you bringing that up.
I think that Representative Hornstein is right. We had the same conversation in Senate local government as well, and we're looking to maybe change that section. I would say, just so you know, the idea we were coming from is oftentimes to do the kind of mixed-use, pedestrian-friendly development we want to do. It's often illegal to do that because the current zoning oftentimes always, prescribes jobs here, housing here, schools over there. So it's that kind of it's that challenge we wanted to get to actually make this legal and change the ordinances, but I appreciate what you're saying about how it's written now, and it does need to be changed.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just had a question related to the fact that the Metropolitan Council in recent years had sued the city of Lake Elmo and won in court. And so I always look at things like this and think, well, where is the next lawsuit coming from that would supersede local control? And can you point to me in here any place where I should be concerned about that? I've been looking through it, but I'm just not sure. But I do have that concern.
Mr. Bailey, or Representative Hornstein,
Mr. Chair, I could answer, and then Representative Hornstein, could as well. This really looks to the Met Council to provide that guidance, and we're actually not, again, this is really a performance-based goal, and it's not saying that every community, for instance, should do transit-oriented development. Every community needs to make sure that they have that they make sure the streets are all safe for walkers and cyclists. It doesn't get into that kind of detail of how they should do it. It's just about setting the regional performance-based goals, so I don't see how a particular community, based on how this is written right now, would individually be sued for not meeting that that goal. I know what you're getting at, and I appreciate the question, but I don't see that in this legislation.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to just quickly elaborate on that. I think this bill is pretty sensitive to local control, and that we really leave it up to the cities to figure out individually how they're going to address this issue. And I think then we would play into, a generally excellent record of comp planning and Met Council give and take. The situation in Lake Elmo was really an exception to the rule. I think the Met Council reviews something like 300 plus comprehensive plans, and I think this is the first time it's come to this, where there was a lawsuit and this extended back and forth between a municipality and the Met Council. It happens here and there. I think Lake Elmo got a lot of headlines, but that is generally, almost exclusively, the exception to the rule. And so I don't see this as changing fundamentally that relationship.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, your bill actually gets to something that we experienced in Chisago County, especially during the boom of the of the early part of this decade, and that was this desire to do more conservation planning, to do more more long-term planning related to development changes, but the inability to of staff resources to get there. And you know, I think that we should look at, to represent Scalzi's question and to your bill, I think we should look at the governance of the Metropolitan Council and the and those long-term changes there. But I do like the this recognition that if we're going to have resources on the ground in the communities that are making these decisions, that they be well trained and that they actually, I mean, I've thought about, can we fund staff positions that are conservation planners that are really doing the work on the ground in our counties and our that could then be shared with the cities within those counties. I think you get closer to that. I don't know that we're actually there, but I think that leads to this issue that our current seven-county definition probably is not really working for what Professor John
Adams,
right? For some reason, I didn't want to call him John Adams, but what Professor John Adams at the U.S. has determined is a 25-county region. So I think, Mr. Chair, I hope that we get a chance to, if we don't get the chance to hear from Representative Hornstein's bill this year, that that be on our agenda for this committee next year to really look at the structure of our region and are there some more structural changes we need to make to achieve the goals of this bill and the other ones that we're hearing.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Hornstein.
Yeah. Thank you very much for those comments, Representative Kalin, and stay tuned because that bill is on the agenda 1 week from today.
Chair, can sponsors still buy ad time for that?
selling tickets. Raise the, try and fill the deficit.
Exactly.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, maybe could you clarify on line 4.4? It says land use and transportation related development projects means projects described in, and then it tells us where they're described. Can you tell me what those are?
I'll ask Mr. Bailey too, but we you know, these are generally larger scale you know, kinds of projects. Mr. Bailey, I think you have the list here. So
Mr. Bailey, would you enumerate us, whatever?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland. I do have the list right here. It's seven. Is it okay if I just read them out really quick? Industrial, commercial, and institutional facilities is one. Solid waste, wastewater systems, that's actually been deleted, so we're not including that now. Residential development, airport projects, highway projects, mixed residential and industrial commercial projects, sport entertainment facilities, land use conversion, including golf courses and recreational trails.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you for that. And then I guess what's the feeling of the Met Council on this kind of a mandate on them in terms of, is there some...
Representative, they're here. I'm not sure if they would want to testify, but I will just tell you that you know, this Representative, Mr. Chairman, Representative, you know this bill, you know, it talks a lot of, about a lot of changes and asks cities and counties and now our metropolitan agency to you know, change a little bit of how they do business to incorporate this greenhouse gas reduction and vehicle miles traveled. We have really met, I hope, most of the concerns of the cities and counties, not all, and we continue to meet with them. You know, we've offered to meet with the Met Council. We know they do have some concerns. We remain committed to meeting with them and discussing that, but, you know, we've asked for that kind of meeting. It hasn't happened yet, but we did have a productive discussion, Mr. Shetman and I, just prior to the hearing. But I know they do have concerns. I think there's some parts of the bill that they support. There's other parts that they oppose. That's all I can say on the record, I think, at this point.
Mr. Shetman, would you like to answer the question for the Met Council? Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Judd Shetman. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council, and Representative Hornstein is correct. We did have a pretty fruitful discussion, at least fruitful in knowing where the Metropolitan Council is coming from and what the intention of this bill does. I will tell you that we are supportive of the language in the amendment that moves the council having to move up our regional development guide to 2013 and begin the comprehensive planning process by 2015. We think that that they make some great points in making sure that we use not the necessarily stale census data that Mr. Bailey speaks to, and we think that that is a good idea. Where we depart from that is what should be contained in those system statements and comprehensive plan guides. We think that the council, through our updated development guide and in system statements, should make recommendations as far as carbon footprint reductions. However, what's included in section 9 and 10 of the Delete Everything Amendment, we think that with the VMT pieces is going a lot further than what we're comfortable with. We would prefer that if cities were interested in doing that, they move forward on a voluntary basis. And the other place that we, I guess, depart from the bill includes the livable communities money being used for that purpose. And I Mr. Chair members, I know that that's in a different section of the bill than what you mentioned. However, the Metropolitan Council is under the purview of the local government committee, and those local for the livable community grants are definitely part of what the council's activities include. And so I think that if you were to do a study, that maybe you would ask the council to do that with those dollars, because we can look at things with a comprehensive planning mind and could provide that same information rather than moving that over to the University of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Shetman. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Keeping in mind that this bill, if it moves out of this committee, is going back to state and local government, and Chair Pawlowski is somewhat reluctant to entertain amendments that should have been accomplished in division, I would like to suggest a possible amendment to Section 3.
And what is your amendment?
Well, I'm wondering if we could clarify the language problem that I think we agreed upon in lines 2.28 and 2.29 simply by, in fact, striking all of the language on line 2.29 and substituting the words implementation of, so that that section, that sentence would read, the Environmental Quality Board shall make grants to local units of government for implementation of the following measurable goals.
Ms. Dyson, does that follow, make sense? And
Mr. Chair, the language fits.
So you want to repeat your goal, or repeat the amendment? So would be delete, would be delete?
It would be to delete all of the language, it would strike all the language on line 29 and insert implementation of.
Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to thank Representative Hilty for that suggestion and urge the committee adopt that amendment.
Does everybody understand the amendment? Any questions, amendments? Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, with Representative Hornstein's approval, I will move that amendment.
So the amendment has been moved. Representative Kalin, do you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hilty, Representative Hornstein, just wondering if we might want your thoughts on adding language that might say to achieve, I think that's the new language, right? To achieve or implementation of, and then, comma, through comprehensive planning and ordinance, comma, the following goals, measurable goals. Just, I do think that it's the planning and the ordinance adoption that I think that is the goal of this section of these grants, and that that's really where the teeth and the actual progress towards those goals happens. Just your thoughts, Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, yes. My thought was that if the local unit of government is focused on achieving the goals, they would know whether they needed to change ordinances in order to do that, and we could leave it to them to figure that out.
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, if only that were so, that the connection between the policy steps and actually making ordinance changes happen, but I will defer to the more senior and learned member to, and I'll follow his lead on this. Just,
that would be Representative Hornstein.
Any other questions on the amendment?
Talking about you.
So if not, we'll proceed to vote on the amendment. On line 2.29, delete that entire line and insert implementation of in its place. And all those in favor of the amendment, say aye. What?
No, I'm fine.
All those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment was adopted. To the bill as amendment, Representative or Mr. Shetman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I just would like to add just a couple more things about where the council takes issue with the bill before us. The first is that they moved with the amendment moved the development guide and the comp plan to 2015, which we support. However, what is required to be included in those the development guide and the comp plan, if that were to become law, that there would only be 10 years for cities to be able to reach those goals, and I think that that's pretty aggressive. And then tagging on to that, section 10, you know, it says here that the council must adopt a policy statement supporting reducing vehicle miles traveled on line 7.4, and then it goes down further and says line 7.12, the council must revise the Metropolitan Development Guide for plans to be consistent with the policy statements. The point I'm trying to make is that is when you say must and you say these are goals, they are a lot stronger than goals, and we will be held to basically making sure that those are included. And we think that is too aggressive. Like I mentioned before, if cities wanted to do something just voluntarily, we'd be happy to participate in that with them. But we think that in the updated regional development guide and comp plans, that we should look at things such as the carbon footprint and working along with the cities to do this. We think that this is too aggressive, but I am happy to say, and this probably isn't enough for everybody in this room here, but we do agree with those goals about trying to change the structure and the timing for those Metropolitan Development Guides and the comprehensive planning process.
Mr. Shetner, are you saying then that if you consider these to be a mandate then?
Mr. Chair and members, we think that that is more than likely how they're going to be interpreted.
Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chair, all I will say to that is I would just renew my invitation to the executive branch to come and talk with myself and the Senate author, Senator Dibble, and, you know, we're open to their suggestions as we were open to the cities and counties. You know, we may not be able to incorporate all of their concerns, but we're certainly interested in, you know, working together to achieve these goals, hear what they have to say, and perhaps amend the bill accordingly. But we have not had that conversation, which to my chagrin, and I again would like to renew, you know, my invitation to the executive branch to work with us on this.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Hilty.
To that point, with all due respect to Mr. Shetman and the Metropolitan Council, I think we've been plenty aggressive in creating these problems, and I don't see anything wrong with being a little bit aggressive and trying to deal with them.
Well said. Representative Eastern.
I want to go back to that to the last comment. I'm just reading on line 616 in the bill. It says the implemented policies shall not mandate that individuals reduce their vehicle miles traveled. And then line 7.4, it says the policy statement must set a goal of reducing regional vehicle miles traveled. I mean, I don't know. There's something conflicting there. I mean, it's the language is a little heavier than just saying we're encouraging people to begin to go down this road. We're just telling people, we're not going to tell people they can't drive more, but we're going to tell the policy statement must set a goal of reducing the regional vehicle miles traveled, which are the miles traveled by the individuals, that you're not going to mandate a reduced mileage. I guess there's just inherently a conflict there that I think is well spoken of by the comments of the
Representative Hornstein.
A quick response. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, and I appreciate that. I mean, I think that's kind of getting to the core of the bill. And I think the way I would address that is that, we're not saying to a particular citizen, this is exactly how you need to, reduce your vehicle miles traveled and do X, Y, Z. But we are saying is to the Met Council and cities, how can we look at land use patterns and development patterns, and in my case, particularly as the chair of the transit committee, how can we give people more choices and more options in order to make that choice to reduce vehicle miles traveled? And even without the provisions in this bill, which I think will enhance the process, we've had a significant increase, a double-digit increase in ridership for Metro Transit. And so, they're doing a decent job with limited resources, but I think it, as Representative Hilty said, could be done and could be done a lot better. And so that's kind of the, I think the framework for this bill is to, really put the onus on the agencies and the public entities to give the public more choices in terms of how to reduce these goals in Subdivision 5. Again, without being heavy-handed on the individual.
Okay. Representative, or Mr. Shetman.
No, Mr. Chair, members, and I appreciate the comments that I'm hearing, and I, like I mentioned before, we did speak with Representative Hornstein prior to this. We will be having additional conversations with him as this bill, I assume, makes its way forward to some of the finance committees as well, and I appreciate that. And I do, I am aware that Representative Hornstein carries most of the Metropolitan Council bills for us as well. So,
thank you, Mr. Shedden. We have some more testifiers. People would like to testify. Ms. Garwick from the Association of Minnesota Counties. And there's some question here about Section 4, whether it does pertain to us, and there's a couple small provisions that do, so I'm going to allow some testimony on that provision.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Annalie Garlitz, and I work with the Association of Minnesota Counties. I would like to start out by thanking Representative Hornstein for working with us on this bill and trying to figure out the answers or some responses to the concerns that we had. Many of the concerns that we initially had from the bill as introduced have been addressed, and that's mostly in the vehicle miles traveled portion of this bill. In the future, we'd just like to say that we've reserved the right to comment on the goals set by the Met Council in the future. Right now, the majority of the concerns that we had about comp plan, what this would mean for local units of government to address these, right now we're waiting to see what the goals set by Met Council will be and if there are costs that are associated with those. But right now we do like the way that part is sitting far better than as introduced. So we do appreciate all of the work. It has been a significant amount of time that's spent addressing the concerns that we have raised. The part that I would like to talk about is Section 4. So thank you for allowing us to bring this up in this committee. Ultimately, AMC would support removing this section of the bill. It raises many concerns for us. This is an area where counties face a lot of lawsuits with environmental assessment worksheets. There are some changes that we did point out, some problems that we did point out earlier this afternoon that have been addressed with this latest amendment, but overall we have some large concerns, and I do have some questions that I would like to raise, and I'm not certain who exactly could help to answer those, but one of the questions that I do have about this portion is whether or not this would apply to the construction of the project or if it's the construction, so would it be the people who are traveling to the construction site and how the construction would have an impact, and we would be factoring the carbon, the greenhouse gas emissions of the construction of the project, or is it the future use of the project? Is it who's living in the home, the vehicle miles traveled by the people that will be living in the home, or any of these provisions as listed on 4.4. We're very curious in finding out the extent to which the regulating government unit will have to address this. And more importantly, if the Environmental Quality Board is able to come up with these answers in their guidance document. That their guidance documents are something that we do rely heavily on. And if the Environmental Quality Board, we'd be really looking to the Environmental Quality Board to address each of these, so it's easy for a local unit of government to look in the guidance document and find the answers that they need. But right now I'm unclear of what exactly we would be calculating the greenhouse gas emissions on. And that's the questions with the Environmental Quality Board and the EAWs is where we really do need to have concise answers for this. So,
and those questions would probably best answered at the Environment Committee.
Mr. Chair, and members, I mean, it's really at your discretion. There are people from the Environmental Quality Board or an individual from the Environmental Quality Board that has expertise in this area. So it would be up to the chair if you want to get into this.
Is it Representative Hornstein, is that person here to answer?
Yes, Kevin or John. We've got a whole bevy of environmental review experts, so you really have both the Environmental Quality Board and Pollution Control.
We can get down through this quickly because we've got the rest of the bills, and we've got a few more testifiers.
Right.
So.
Pollution Control Agency and Environmental Quality Board are here, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm John Wells, staff of the Environmental Quality Board. Our environmental review expert actually just left 5 minutes ago thinking you weren't going to deal with Section 4, and he has a hearing tonight in, at Fort Snelling on changing the environmental review rule. But all I would do is say that the EQB would be very much committed to working with local governments and their representatives, as well as all various interests in climate change, to make sure that our guidance was straightforward and easy to follow. That's what we do.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's what. Thank you, Mr. Wells. But I'm not sure if that answers the question that was raised. But
well, we would work as the bill as amended remarks and now states that we would identify published guidance on how to calculate carbon footprints and so forth and tap that as it would be appropriate, as it's available. If it's not available, if there's not information, we wouldn't have the capability to create it out of thin air, but we would work with the existing knowledge about climate change and what causes climate change gases.
So, Mr. Wells, the question, as I heard it from Ms. Garlitz, was how would this apply to the construction of the project? Would the workers who are driving to this project to build it, would their carbon footprint be added into this, and or would the people have to be living on site to meet that? I guess that's kind of the question she was asking.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for reminding me of that. Members, environmental review is developed around the project itself, not using the construction of the project. So
it would be the end use then.
Yeah, the end use.
Right. Okay. Mr. Johnson, you've got a question? Or not a question, but you'd like to testify. Please introduce yourself for the tape. And
thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the Legal Minnesota City is going for the hat trick tonight, testifying on all three bills. So, the League of Minnesota Cities would like to join the counties in thanking Representative Hornstein. We've put a lot of time into this bill over this session and working on addressing our concerns, and it really has improved significantly. My comments can be fairly brief, that the issues I have raised in my testimony, both here in the House hearing and in the Senate, have been attempts to be addressed by the delete all amendment and the amendment to it that was made in this committee today. I do hope we can continue to look at some of the concerns raised by the Met Council and by counties to make sure they're covered, but the things that I had asked to be addressed were addressed in those two amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Todd Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Todd Olson. I'm with Metro Cities. I'll keep my comments very brief. First off, we'd like to thank Representative Hornstein. His work with the stakeholders on most of our concerns on this bill, we spent a lot of time, as the others have said. I'd like to speak on just two issues, the vehicle miles traveled and the change in timelines for submitting the comp plans. We do appreciate the change from the original bill to move the comp plan submission date from 2013 to 2015. Aligning plans closer to the release of census data does have merit. That being said, we are concerned that for some cities, accelerating the deadline from where it is now, which is 2018, to 2015 could present a burden that they cannot afford. Asking cities to accelerate the next round of comp plans in an era in which they are facing reduced resources will be a problem for many cities, particularly smaller cities. Comp plans require a lot of time and money, and having sufficient resources to help cities is very important, and this bill does address some of those issues, but we remain concerned that for many cities, this accelerated timeline would be difficult. For example, the city of Excelsior spent $50,000 on preparing their 2008 comp plan. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, the VMT goals would require a significant additional state resources, particularly for transit and other planning and development needs for cities. A lack of sufficient resources already exists for cities to meet Met Council goals and objectives. Under this bill, there would be an even greater need for additional resources for cities to be able to attain the goals under this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Any questions for the testifiers? Anybody else in the audience would like to speak for or against the bill? If not, Representative Hornstein, do you have any summation?
No, just thank you for a great discussion, Mr. Chair and members, and I'm very confident that we'll be able to at least address in part some of the Met Council's concerns and look forward to our discussions with them.
Thank you. Then Representative Hornstein renews his motion to pass House File 898, recommended to be passed and re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government as amended. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Ayes have it. Motion prevails. The bill was passed.
Thank you, Mr.
Ayes have it. Motion prevails. The bill was passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Sterner, the minutes from March 13th.
Thank you, Chair. That meeting was very invigorating. I was there and I read through the minutes, and it looked like they're in great order. I motion to approve the minutes as shown.
The motion has been made to approve the minutes from the March 13th as printed. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Aye. Motion passed. Motion prevailed.
Representative Eastland.
An announcement, we have a meeting. We're going to have another meeting on Friday. We're going to have to get bills heard to get done before deadline. We're going to be meeting this Friday again, repeating 1 and 2:30. Hopefully we can be more concise in our testimony and not so much filibustering, and we can get out of there on time and maybe even early. With that, the meeting's adjourned.